Jack Werrett, The Flood Man, by Rebecca Lloyd. When I waved at the Werrett sisters from the room at the top of the house I'd chosen as my study, their somber faces lightened slightly, yet they did not come forward to the front door, but stood just outside the low, rusty gate, glancing from time to time behind them across the frozen marsh. I thought I'd settled everything with them at our first meeting and wouldn't have to speak to them again until the week of my leaving. I saw that they had bundles and packages with them, and wondered if they'd brought me extra contents for the house, as apart from its coldness, it was Spartan in every respect, with its tall, thin-glassed windows, narrow, sloping corridors. When I'd first met the sisters, in the cafe in Stabman's Reach, I noticed that although they seemed keen on the rent money, they were at the same time curiously hesitant about going ahead with the deal. "For how long will you wantin'?" one of them asked me. "Around 5 months," I said. Sorry to be vague. Sorry it's such a short time. "That ain't so much short as long, seeing as we've never let anyone in there before," Marina told me. "This lark is all new to us, you see." I smiled at her. Her sister, Betty, didn't speak, but stared out through the cafe window while she shredded a paper napkin into tiny strips and dropped the pieces into a puddle of tea in front of her. "How about if I stay until the end of March?" I suggested. They did not answer immediately, but gazed at each other across the table, and I had time to study them. Their hair was faded brown and dry and held together at the napes of their thin necks with coloured hair slides made for little girls. The skin on their faces was wind-roughened and thick, and they squinted, not just, I sensed, as a reflex to protect themselves from the wild weather of the marshlands, but also in defence against a world of strangers, about which they harboured deep suspicions. "Are you going to be in him all the time?" Marina asked, finally, stretching her hand across the table to lay it on top of her sister's moving fingers. "In the house, you mean?"
"Will you stop your jifflin', Betty?"
"Yes, Miss Wood. Of course, in the house." "Doctor Wood," I reminded her. "I'll be out a fair bit taking photographs of churches," I offered, peering at them through the watery light. "But sometimes I'll be inside all day." "Why?" Marina shrugged. "He was just wondering," she said.
"You want to be careful of fees in these parts," Betty whispered. "Kids with hidden faces have been breaking into cars and such like late."
"Well, I've been offered several other places around Stabman's Reach," I told them. "If you're not sure." Betty's chin trembled, and I could see she wanted to say something else, but her sister's fingers tightened suddenly over hers. The cafe was steamy and noisy and full of the smell of burnt toast, and I wanted to get business done and be on my way.
"The only reason we asked was you'll need paraffin for the ears," Marina said quickly. "We can get the paraffin man to go out to the house. At least he might. Depends."
I took out my checkbook, and the sisters stared down at it in wonderment.
"We don't use them things. We don't do nothing of that sort, we don't,"
Betty said, glancing at Marina. "Well, shall we draw up an agreement, and shall I get you cash instead?"
"No. No agreements wrote down on paper," Marina said loudly. "We're not having anything of that lark."
"It wouldn't make any difference if it was wrote or not, if..."
Betty muttered.
"I would appreciate it if you could tell the paraffin man about me," I persisted, trying to mentally circumvent their curious behaviour.
"And just how far is the house from Stabman's Reach?" The sisters looked at each other again, this time for the answer, it seemed. Couple of mile, no more than that. Not a lot, anyway. I followed their instructions and found the old house on the edge of the marsh, although it was further away from the village than they'd described it. It struck me as a peculiar place in which to have built a house, as there was not a single tree to be seen, and the horizon was as flat and straight as a piece of neatly folded cloth. The sky was the whole thing, and on that day the dark clouds were dense and hanging. I was not pleased to see the Werrett sisters standing at the gate just 2 weeks later. As they would not move from their position, I was obliged to walk out to them, and I realized they must have come from the village on foot. The coldness had cast a white shadow across the marsh for as far as could be seen, and that same sense of whiteness was in the air itself. The women were frozen. "It's bitter out here," I said. "Come inside, quickly." "Stingy old weather today," Marina answered, staring over my shoulder at the house. "We come across the khan, sir. It's worse out there." "You been all right so far, Miss Wood?" I nodded and turned sharply back to the house, but on that day it wasn't much warmer inside because wind was booming down the chimneys, making mockery of the damp, stuffy warmth put out by the single, huge and stinking paraffin heater. As I led the sisters into the drawing room with its vast windows, it seemed to me that they were examining every surface. The windowsills, the floor, the skirting boards, and the ornate ceiling. "I haven't damaged anything. I haven't had time yet." "Sorry, that was a bad joke," I said, and was startled when they began to laugh quite wildly. "Oh, Miss Wood!" Even from the other side of the room, however, I could see that while they were making the sounds of laughter, their rough, narrow faces suggested they were afraid of something. "What is it you're looking for?" I asked, hoping to sound gentle now and trustful. Marina stepped forward. "He was a bad joke, seeing as you're educated, and educated people don't destroy things. No, we was just looking for water. Sometimes there's water. Has there been?" "Anywhere," Betty put in. "Do you mean, is the house leaking?" Marina shrugged. "Leaking is one thing, yes." I thought for a minute. "No, I can't say I've noticed any leaks, Miss Werrett." And I looked upwards at the ceiling to search it for damp spots. As if suddenly influenced by the women and their concern, I did not trust my own words. "It's really cold in the bathroom, though," I said to prompt them further. "I guess it's to be expected in a house like this that rears right up out of nothing on the edge of a marsh." The women didn't seem to have heard me. With such frosts and savage winds and no trees for miles, I continued, entranced by their oblivion. "Your card in the newsagent said a quiet house wanted, it did, which is why we thought he might suit," Marina said loudly, as if suddenly in attendance of the moment again. "Oh, it does suit, please. Don't think otherwise. I've heard it's like the tropics in London, palm trees and coconuts and things," Betty announced suddenly. "Someone told me that's been. Holy Tarzan country, according to him." "Don't be so soft," Marina whispered. "Miss Wood will think us ignorant, she will." "Well, it is warmer in London than up here," I told them. "It's Dr. Wood, by the way. But I'd be happy for you to call me Megan." I saw Betty nudge Marina as they stood side by side, looking at me, and both of them simultaneously cleared their throats and joined hands.
We don't want to crowd you, we don't, but we're moving in, Marina declared. Today.
The room darkened as they spoke, and I shifted closer to them so that I could look properly into their strange faces.
You're going to do what?
Our things is by the gate, Marina said. Betty will step out for them.
I laughed.
The idea is I pay you money, and in exchange you let me live in the house alone and undisturbed.
We won't disturb you, she answered. Do we do, you can tell us to scupper. We'll cook for you and take your clothes to the laundrette, that type of thing.
Keep our eye on everything,
Betty added, looking upwards once again. They were perplexing. It seemed they were holding each other's hand for comfort. And I suspected also that Marina was able to control what Betty said that way.
I don't need your help, I told them.
That type of housework takes the whole livelong day. At least in these parts it do, even if it don't in London.
And you said you had to work on your church things, Marina reminded me.
And we don't want paying, we don't,
Betty said.
What?
We want to look after you, Marina replied. And she tried a smile that seemed to me cringing and false.
Betty's a good cook. We won't do nothing to get us wrong.
As we'd been standing there in the top room, a vicious howler of a wind, worse than the persistent one, had torn across the marsh, and it was as if it had wrapped itself several times round the house and was intent on full entry.
That's rafty out there,
Betty whispered.
There's plenty of rooms in this big old house, and we'll be quiet like little mice, Marina said. You won't even see us if you don't want to.
I knew quite suddenly that part of me welcomed the idea of them staying. It was as if all the time I'd spent there so far, I'd been in a strange state of caution. As if I hadn't breathed the air quite normally. As if, in fact, I was trespassing.
You told me when we met that you lived in a council house on the edge of Stabman's Reach, I said, struck suddenly by an unsettling thought.
Can we get our things in now?
Betty asked, staring at me intensely, her wide, whiskery mouth slightly ajar.
But this house is really yours, isn't it? I asked them, as I was wondering how a couple of impoverished countrywomen could own a four-story Georgian property of such grandeur.
The sisters glanced at each other, nodded hard.
We do own him, we do, Marina whispered. It's in our family.
Blast me, Miss Wood, can I get our things before that drat window?
Betty asked.
The council knows where it's on this house, if that's what's bothering you, Marina said. And I saw that she'd intuited my thought.
But they still give us a place to live far away from here,
Betty put in, speaking quickly.
You two are the owners, then?
I persisted. The sisters looked at each other in a curious, hard sort of fighting manner that they must have imagined I couldn't see. And it was that look, more than everything they'd said, that aroused my curiosity about them mightily. And perhaps it was that alone that caused me to decide.
This is a very odd business, I said, speaking to them slowly. But go on then, bring your bags in. Only remember I've paid you a lot of money, so things had better work out between us.
It can't be denied that at first my life was easier in the old place when the sisters moved in. Sometimes I could hear them creeping about in the corridors or up and down the wooden staircase, talking in low voices. But for the most part, they stayed in the gloomy kitchen and managed to keep it quite warm in there. Betty cooked heavy pies and meat and rough, gritty vegetables like swedes and turnips, and the heat from the range took the chill out of the air. We fell into a pleasing routine, pleasing at least to me, as all my meals were provided. And it was curious how quickly I adapted to the arrangement and took it for granted that hot food would be ready for me when I was hungry. I'd never been married, but I could now understand that for a certain type of man, being cooked for must be a powerful reason not to leave a wife, however greatly he might despise her. I was getting on well with my research. Quite often, as I drove out to photograph my next church, I'd give the sisters a lift into Stabman's Reach to get groceries or to go to the laundrette, or occasionally I'd drop them in the local town where they hardly would venture normally. On the way home, they'd sit together with their arms linked in the back of my car and tell me in some detail what they'd seen and done. Then I became aware that they'd developed a way of talking to me in a slightly formal but jovial and overbearing manner, and it began to tire me, so that when we ate together I tried not to inadvertently encourage the behaviour through inquiry of any kind. But at the same time, Marina had a series of ploys to stop Betty speaking too much. I'd noticed it right at the beginning of our acquaintance. If she did not tell her directly to be quiet, she'd nudge her or step on her foot right there in front of me. I was fascinated by the fact that they imagined I could see and understand nothing, but could not tell if it was my presence that was causing their behaviour, or if, like two old trees, they'd grown twisted together over time and habitually performed their strange double act, like old married couples often do. In any event, beneath their chatter, I intuited there was something they were hiding from me. But I'd become used to their eccentricities, and imagined that while it might have been something of enormous importance to them, if they were to reveal it, I would find it as laughable as coconuts growing in London. When the frost had thawed, and the wind changed direction, the sisters took to going for walks across the marshes. From the top rooms I worked, I could watch them until they became as small as little peg dolls in the distance. And as I was engaged in doing that one morning, a bead of water slid down the wall beside me. And, glistening in the light as it did, it caught my eye. I stood up and looked at the ceiling, but there was no obvious dampness there. And just as I was about to sit down again, I noticed a small, shiny puddle of water on the floor, close to my desk. Again, on searching, I could not find its origins. My workroom was not directly beneath the bathroom, but going up the little flight of back stairs, and opening the bathroom door, I was momentarily startled as if I'd burst in on someone using it. Both taps were dripping. But after feeling about under the sink around all the heavy pipework, my fingers came away dry. The sisters returned before noon. They'd been down to the reed beds to watch the marshmen at their harvesting work, they told me. "Mostly werrets down there," Marina said. "The reeds is for thatching."
"Your family are thatchers?"
"No, Miss Wood. Marshmen." "So marshmen cut the reeds, then?" She nodded. "Marshmen do plenty of things. To do with water, that is." Betty nodded too, and then began to bite her bottom lip.
"Stop it, Betty," Marina said, hitting her arm hard. "Don't do that. You ain't fell apart yet." "She's faring badly today," she explained. "She gets troubled a lot." "I can't help it when I step into this house," Betty said. "Looking about to see all the time. Nor can you, Rena. It's just you won't admit." We were sitting around the table in the kitchen, and it was so dark on that deep winter day that we had all the lights on and the shutters closed to keep out the dreariness. I hesitated to pry into their business, and I got the impression they didn't expect me to pursue the conversation, so I changed it. "There was a strange little bottle of water in the house this morning," I told them. Betty stood up instantly,
and went such a weird colour that she really did frighten me. Marina stood up too, and reaching out, took her sister by the shoulders, and seemed to be both caressing and shaking her at the same time. The hissing sound of Marina's voice when she spoke caused my back to arch with alarm. I sensed I was witnessing something intimate between them, a thing that had happened many times, and if I'd felt superior to these women before, I did no longer. Rather, I began to feel a slowly creeping dis-ease in their company. Then, as if suddenly coming to, Betty pulled herself away from Marina and stared at her.
"Told you so," she said.
"What's going on?" I asked them.
"You were on the lookout for water when you first moved in here, remember? That's why I let you know about it." "Wait till we go out," Betty said. "Then you get in and do it."
I could see that Marina was struggling to stop her sister talking, so that the pretense of normality could be re-established. But I've become determined now to make these women speak to me candidly. "Who waits till you go out, Betty?"
"Don't take no notice of her. She's a real splatter girl," Marina said quickly. "Has been since a child."
"It's time you both levelled with me," I answered. "I'm getting tired of your weirdness."
"Where was he?"
Marina asked, craning her neck forward as if to inspect me.
"What? The water, you mean? Upstairs by the table I'm working at."
Betty sat down again and pulled her slide out so that her wintry brown hair fell forward and partially hid her face.
"Don't think we can now," she whispered. "Look after you." "We should stand up to him," Marina said. "About time we did."
"You mean deal with the water problem?" I asked, and my growing frustration at their refusal to confide in me must have shown in the tone of my voice.
"I wiped it up. Do you want to see where it was?" "Seeing the place won't help," Betty said.
"So you don't care? If this house was mine, I'd want to know." Neither of them responded. Marina sat down beside her sister and began to fiddle with the little pink heart-shaped hair slide.
"You know, you're the strangest couple of landladies I've ever met. And I'm not sure that things are working out. You make me think this house really isn't yours to let out in the first place."
They looked up at me, startled and angry, and Betty's eyes glinted through her veil of hair.
"It does belong to us," she said. "But there's a certain Werrett man that's our uncle who thinks it belonged to him, he do."
Marina turned slowly towards her sister, and reaching out, took her hair from her face, and shushing her the while, put the hair slide back in carefully. I was pleased with most of my photos, even though the light was sometimes difficult to work in. I had some dramatic pictures of churches with round towers. There was one in particular I intended to visit again because I suspected that the west wall of the nave was from Saxon times, and that it did originally have a round tower. I'd seen a lot of Saxon stonework, sometimes hidden away within the complexities of the churches I'd visited, and I'd found a lovely Saxon doorway into the church at St. Lucas. The sisters had made themselves especially scarce since their confession that they were in dispute about the house with one of their male relatives, and I decided not to press them about it. Should some Werrett man loom up and disrupt our arrangement and I had to leave, I'd move into the little hotel next to the doctor's surgery in the local town for the remainder of my stay. I decided also not to tell them about the damp patches I was finding from time to time on my bedspread in the room in which I slept, as I would return later only to discover that they'd dried out completely. It took me a while to realize that I only found dampness or beads of water or small puddles on the floor when the two of them were out. As queer as this was, as my work progressed, I was more and more inclined to want to stay put, as the house was in a perfect position in relationship to the villages and churches that were of most interest to me. I hadn't forgotten, either, Betty's response the first time I'd told them about the puddle by my desk, and I did not want to witness that hysteria again. As the weeks passed, the women were spending more time outside the house than in it, and I had begun to notice that before their departure they would gaze at each other, and I could not rid myself of the impression they were transmitting unspoken thoughts, a notion I found so unsettling that each time they did it, I felt my stomach tighten in response. Although they revealed little about themselves, I gathered that they'd lived in the house as children, and that it had belonged to a relative who had come upon good times, as they described it, quaintly. Often, when they left the house, they took a basket with them, and I supposed they were taking food down to the reed harvesting. Usually I felt nothing but relief to be without them for a while, as by now there was something shiny and suspicious about Betty's face all the time, as if she was constantly on the verge of tears or fury, and I was sick of the sight of it. But one clear and cloudless morning of some beauty, I discovered quite suddenly as I gazed after them that I didn't want to be alone, and I startled myself terribly with the realization. I stood up quickly and walked to the window. My impulse was to run after them. I felt bereft, and the closest I can remember to such a feeling before was when I was a child, and I nearly lost my mother in a crowd. In this unsettled mood, I walked through the house, opening doors and briefly looking into shadowy rooms. I thought I'd head down to the kitchen and stay in the warmth there and wait for them. If they were going to the reed beds again the following day, I intended to ask if I could join them. After all, it would be interesting to meet members of their family, which I'd come to understand was a huge and straggling thing with quite a lot of doubt about the exact nature of the relationships between some of them. On the way down the stairs, I stopped. One step was very wet, and the one below it had upon it an unusually rounded and quivering pool of water across its whole length. On an instant, I was seized with fear. Huge and irrational, and more real than I can describe. So repulsive was the idea of placing my foot on either step that the water may as well have been thickened and congealing blood. In my heightened state, I became convinced that it had been deposited there deliberately to halt me in my progress down to the kitchen. I feel strange about what I did next, because it could surely only be regarded as the action of a madwoman. But I swung my leg over the banister and inched my way downwards past the two grotesque steps and onwards to the bottom in that manner. I took up a position at the kitchen table and determined that I would wait there until the sisters came home, as it was now beyond my courage to walk freely around the house while I was alone in it. When they did return, they stood talking in the hall for some time, and I could plainly hear them. I heard Marina say, "But I can't do the cooking as good as you, and she wouldn't like that if she's a doctor, as she keeps saying. We should never have agreed to it in any case," Betty replied. "We ain't servants to the Iron Mighty." "Oh, I don't mind her. I don't. She don't know no better. At least she ain't nasty particular. She couldn't learn me nothing, even if she is high learned. Do you don't go, Bay. Please don't leave me here on my own." "I can't stay, Rainer. I'm Dilford. Every time I walk round a corner or into another room, I'm all on a dudder just in case. I know you're only afraid, but we did agree. That's a lot of money, so it's worth it." "Blast the money, Rainer. I can't set my two eyes on him, but I'd be dead, I know it. It's different for you, being a favourite of his." Now I could hear them coming nearer, and I prepared myself as best I could. I took in a couple of deep breaths and exhaled slowly through my mouth. Marina came in first.
"Oh, Miss Wood, you give us a fright," she said.
And as she had so often done before, she parted her lips and displayed her goat-like teeth in an unpleasant parody of a smile. Betty, however, said nothing in greeting to me. Instead, she gazed into my face with unashamed intensity, and after a few minutes' hesitation, sat down opposite me and began to frown.
"Kettle's hot," I said, and could think of nothing else to follow it with. "Stop gawping at Miss Wood, Betty. What's the matter with you, putting on parts like that?"
"Look at that face," Betty whispered. "Something's happened."
"Don't mind Betty, Miss Wood. She's as dizzy as they come. She talks a load of squit."
I put my elbows on the table and my face in my two hands to hide from Betty's gaze, but it was far too late for that.
"You came up against him," Betty whispered. "You saw he, and he saw you."
Where I thought I might find some simple human companionship and solace, the women had done nothing but increase my fear. I stood up, I think, and stared at each of them in turn.
"He! You call everything he! The doors, the windows, the chairs, the tables are all he! Which he are you talking about now?" I shouted.
The sisters looked at each other.
"She don't know, Betty,"
Marina said.
"The poor lamb hasn't worked it out."
For once, Betty took command of the situation.
"You best come outside with us," she whispered. "We can't see nothing inside here. We can't."
"There's a tempest out there, Betty," Marina said. "We'll be soaked to the bone."
"I ain't saying nothing inside the house," Betty persisted.
And Marina and I had no option but to accompany her out through the front door and a good distance along the marsh path before she stopped and turned to face us, deadly white and shaking. There was a hooligan of a wind out there, and the sky was full of roiling clouds of deadly grey, shot through with strands of purple, and air was yellow and thunderous. I was frozen within minutes, and afraid.
"Come here close," Betty said. "And you mean her, because it's you to do the saying of the name, not me."
"For Christ's sake," I muttered when I was within inches of her face.
"Must everything be so dramatic, woman?"
Marina had pressed in behind me so that her lips were close to my ear. It was as if I was sandwiched between two lunatics.
"It's true what my sister says," she whispered.
"Do she tell you we might go for her, or do I tell you we won't?"
"Well, get on with it and tell me then."
I felt Marina's breath on the back of my neck.
"Jack, wear it," she whispered. "He's only at war with us. He thinks he owns the house, but he don't. We do. Marina will cook for you," Betty said. "She don't cook as good as me, accordingly to her, but I ain't going back in there now the name is out. Marina will pack my things and bring them out to the gate. She's only afraid, she is,"
Marina whispered.
"She don't want him jumping on her out of the dark. She don't like he did when we were kids."
"Oh, for Christ's sake, this is ridiculous. At least if you must go, Betty, let me take you to Stabman's Reach in my car."
Betty shook her head and looked over my shoulder at the house.
"I can walk. The fell gate will still be open this time of day. I should never have come here in the first place."
"Why did you? I was happy on my own," I said.
We turned then and began the walk back to the house. As we approached, every window glinted in the light, and images of moving clouds showed upon them strongly.
"It was Rena's master's plan to come here. She got it into her head you'd be better off with us to watch over you."
"Do you have to do everything together, though?" I asked.
"We mostly always have," Marina said. "It's never been taught out of us."
As Marina and I walked into the house, I glanced up at the staircase. In the shadow-filled light, I could not see if the two steps were still wet, but not being inclined to loiter about in the proximity of the stairs, I headed for the kitchen while Marina packed Betty's things and took them out to her. I was close to finishing my research, and because of all the queer and hysterical stuff that had gone on, I was considering leaving too in a week or so. When Marina came down to the kitchen, she put her finger to her lips, although it had not been my intention to speak at that moment anyway. "Don't mind Betty," she said. "She's a dancy-headed morsel, and she do run on, and that's a fact. When I took her bags out, I promised her I wouldn't say that name inside the house, so nor must you mind, not even once. And if you ask me, it's best not even to think about it." I shrugged and stood up to make us some tea. "It must be hard for you sometimes, having such a nervous sister. I've got a difficult one as well, so we're similar in that respect. Look, now Betty's gone, I need to tell you about something odd that happened to me this morning. We ain't the least bit similar, Miss Wood, we ain't. Nobody's like the Werrets. Nobody but the Werrets themselves," I said, attempting to smile at her. "Listen, Miss Wood, I'm wholly frazzled myself. It's not easy being here, so don't tell me no stories. I ain't in the mood to hear them." Her narrow face was skull-like and white, and the darkness of her eyes unsettled me. But I did not look away. "Okay, then, I was going to ask you something else as well. If I were to take a day off work tomorrow, and you're going to the Reed Beds game, could I come too?" "What? Not working, Miss Wood?" Marina said, and she put a sly emphasis on working. "Do you come?" she went on. "You'll just get cold. And there ain't nothing down there to see besides a lot of men and reeds. Howsomever, I suppose there's no harm in tourists seeing what real work is. Yes, Miss Wood, all right, you can come. Although it's a tidy step it is." Being with Marina in the quiet gloom of the kitchen made me feel calm once more, and it was as if my episode of fear was some freak occurrence that no longer mattered. I was left now with an itching curiosity about the lives of these women, and what it was that caused them so much dread. I put a mug of tea on the table in front of her. "So will he be working there in the reed beds?" I asked eventually. She did not answer me immediately. It was as if I had said something so repulsive that she was unable to draw breath into her lungs properly. "Sorry I was being nosy," I said. "It was just something to say." "Well, which is it? Are you curious or not curious?" she asked, suddenly very still and solemn. "Since I've learnt he's involved in a dispute about this house with you, I have been very curious, yes." "You don't see it, do you?" she whispered, squinting at me as if I was some low, verminous creature. The following morning was full of silvery light, and the sky, which had pressed in upon us, heavy with rain and disturbance in the days before, was calm, and mottled with strands of drifting white cloud. It was a fair walk to the reed beds, but if for no other reason I was pleased I'd gone with Marina because her mood shifted from one of solemnity to a cheerfulness that I could see for once was perfectly genuine. She asked me questions about London. How many people lived there, what kind of work they all did, and whether there really were coconuts growing in the city. We came finally to an estuary inlet, where a small knot of men, mostly elderly, were scything down the dry reeds, and stacking them on the bank in what Marina described to me as sheaves. For a while, the men did not acknowledge us as we stood watching them, Marina with her arms folded, and I with my hands in my coat pockets. Eventually, one of them looked in our direction and nodded briefly. "She's come down to make sure you're all doing your work proper, Tom," Marina said. "Betty's took off?" he asked, wading through the water to the bank. "Scattered yesterday," Marina said. "She wouldn't bide there longer." "Well, ain't that a caution?"
he declared, keeping his eyes steadily on my face. I sensed that the small gesture he made to Marina with the side of his mouth and the quick movement of his eye was understood by her instantly, and once more I was under the impression that thoughts were transmitted between the two, as it had been with Betty.
"This is one of my uncles," Marina explained. "He knows a deal more than me about certain things he does. She's only curious, Tom. Betty made such a business of it. Couldn't do it quietly."
"So, what have you told?" he asked her.
It was as if the question, even though spoken in no more than a whisper, was heard by the other men as they came through the water and formed a silent group around him.
"Nothing proper," Marina said. "I thought you could tell about some of the miracles and marvels, seeing as you're his generation and was witness to things a mite more than me and Betty ever was."
Tom nodded and took some time to inspect my face in great detail. And I, in response, tried not to look down or blink. And then, as if dragging something heavy upwards that had for a long time lain rotting on the earth, he began to speak.
"We don't say the name these days, and it's better that way because it's a rum old do, and that's a fact. But that man can do with water. It's more than masters. He done it even as a boy. We all seen it in our time. He can make water rise up. He can make it into shapes. Surprising shapes like women and dogs and waves and funnels and spouts. And once I heard he made a staircase out of water. And he climbed up it to the very top, he did, so he could look out and at a distance."
"I heard that too," one of the other men whispered. "And he could walk straight across the top of any kind of water, if he had the mind to. Round these parts, we call him the Flood Man. And what about that time he made them water horses and had them galloping all over the marsh? He can't have been more than 14 when he done that."
I listened without flinching to this lunacy, as I could see the men's eyes watching me with the utmost care, as if they were waiting for me to display my scorn. But I was caught in a strange condition in which my mind did not believe him, but evidenced by the creeping of my skin and the churning of my gut, my body decidedly did. As Tom talked, it came to my mind that the morning I had gone to my room to find my pillow and blanket wet, the damp area had been in the shape of a human form, as if someone had bathed and then lain down wet on my bed, or someone who was always wet had lain down. A different, more primitive area of my thinking suggested.
"He went away to Italy or such foreign parts and used to send us postcards from time to time. When he came home, he came with money, and seeing as he bought that big old house, I'd say it was a great deal of money.
We think he must have got rich by showing off his tricks to foreigners," Marina added.
I did not utter a single word in response and did not speak to Marina on the way home either. I was aware that she glanced at me sideways from time to time, and things unspoken hung there in the cold air between us, like a line of washing made stiff with frost. By the time the house came into sight on the horizon, I deduced that Jack Werrett practiced hypnotism, and what better victims than a group of uneducated men who'd known each other all their lives, and had scarcely been further than Stabman's reach, men who'd managed, beneath their natural male arrogance, to retain the pure innocence and imagination of children. It wasn't my area of study, but I believed I'd come across the makings of modern folklore, and knew there'd be people at the university who'd be thrilled to have been with me, listening to the marshman's story. As Marina and I stood together at the front door of the house with its faded blue paint, we looked at each other very frankly for the first time, all posturing and politeness gone.
"Thank you for taking me there," I began. "But look, the
Before we go in, I want to know if you've actually seen your uncle inside the house. Because I certainly have not. Betty says you have seen him, she replied. She could tell from your face yesterday. No. A strange thing happened on the stairs that perturbed me, I said. The thing I tried to tell you about the other day. Water was in it, she responded. Yes. And most peculiar it was, I told her. There you are then, she said, opening the front door. You've seen him, like Betty said. It's just you ain't allowing yourself to know it proper. I saw no point in arguing with her. It appeared that in her mind the water had become the man himself, and for all I knew the merging of one thing into another, shape-shifting, one could say, was a common phenomenon in the creation of folk tales. I became convinced the theory was entirely plausible, and I reflected on the fact that these remote country people did not distinguish objects from humans, addressing all as he. When finally Marina was ready to hear my story, I know I spoke to her in a very flat tone, as a remnant of the fear I'd felt the day before had returned, and I didn't want her to become aware of it in my voice. Do you know what surface tension is? I asked. She frowned and looked as if she was about to roll her eyes. It's that bulge you see around a drop of water before it flattens out and sinks away, I went on. I came downstairs yesterday and saw that two of the steps were wet, but the second one was quivering with a great dome of water like a blown-up pillow. It was unnatural. Menacing. Like a gigantic blob, Marina said, shifting her eyes away from my face and staring fixedly at the china on the dresser behind me. She was as pale as I had ever seen her over the few months we'd lived together. Perhaps it was because she did not respond immediately that I laughed suddenly, as in truth our situation was ridiculous. But the sound of my laughter came ricocheting back to me, high-pitched and startling, and I realized my nerves were completely shot away. Marina turned her eyes upon me again. "We've got to leave this bleeding house," she said. "We should leave today. Only the fell gate is closed until tomorrow, so you'll have to come to Stabman's Reach the long way round on foot with me. Leave your stuff here." "Not without my car," I replied. "Absolutely not." "Did you step on that water? Did you put your foot in it?" I couldn't bring myself to. Couldn't bear the idea of contact with it, I replied. Marina Werrett stared at me, her head lowered and her dark eyes steady on my face. "I'd hoped you'd be safe with me here," she whispered. "Used to like me. Come over to the village and I'll give you back some money. You to say the amount. I don't care." "I'll leave the minute the gate is open tomorrow," I told her. "I'm not going to abandon my work and my car overnight for anything. I'll meet you in that cafe tomorrow at 10. I gazed down at her big hands with their swelling knuckles and felt a great rush of liking for her as it dawned on me fully that she was terrified of Jack Werrett and she'd only come to live in the house for my sake, thinking me somehow in danger. "Come away from here now," she whispered. "Put your things in your car. Drive it over to the track by that fell gate and leave it there until morning. I'll walk back with you to collect it tomorrow and have it broken into by kids with no faces." "No. There ain't no kids. At least I ain't advised of it." "Betty said there was. She may have said it, but it ain't true. It would have put you off." I cut the conversation short, and Marina went to pack her bag so that she could get away before the afternoon gathering of heavy clouds and rain. I listened hard as she climbed the stairs, thinking I would hear her cry out when she reached the two steps, but I heard nothing except the plaintive wailing of a band of curlews flying across the vast expanse of nothingness outside. Within a short while, Marina was back downstairs and wanting to be on her way. "Did you come across the wet steps?" I asked her. She shook her head.
You'd have heard me if I did do. I'd have shrieked, I would.
I was relieved to some extent, although I sensed already that my nervousness about being left alone had begun to manifest itself in the tightness of my throat and the alertness of my gaze. I walked to the front door with her.
I don't know why you couldn't have just talked to your uncle and explained about renting out the house,
I murmured.
Talk, Miss Wood. Talk, she repeated.
She looked at me directly, and although her gaze was level, her expression was bewildering. It was sour and cunning and full of sorrow. Then fleetingly something pleading entered her face. And mockery followed that, but all this resolved finally into resignation and withdrawal. She left the house without looking back, and I stood in the doorway watching her for a while, and thinking hard about Jack Werrett, the cause of all this trouble. And I did not know if he was a man, myth, or water, or all three. He could be anything. When Marina finally disappeared from sight, I returned to the grey interior, the rooms, the stairs, and the narrow corridors. The light, as it so often did in that house, had changed meanwhile. An even deeper gloominess seemed all about me. Then, as I lingered, a monstrous idea came to me about Jack Werrett. For not only had I understood suddenly Marina's last look and her urgency to be away, but I knew also that she couldn't bring herself to tell me in plain words for fear of my derision. I don't know if my knowledge made me more or less alarmed at spending a night alone, as I was already so agitated by all that had gone on with the Werrett sisters. But my realization shifted the weight of my thoughts, and on one level the understanding was a relief, and to my advantage, for I had never been a believer in such matters as those. Revenants. Ghosts. Visitants. The act of a simpleton, perhaps. But I went slowly through all the rooms downstairs and put the lights on, and likewise on the three floors upstairs, halting at the two wooden steps that had unhinged me. They were dry, as Marina had reported. I found myself mentally calculating the number of hours that must pass before I could leave this forlorn place and return to all the garish, comforting brightness of town and city, with noise and lights and ugly shop signs. And most of all, throngs of ordinary people. I decided that I would put my papers in order and pack my belongings so that I was ready to abandon the house first thing. I would have breakfast in Stabman's Reach so as not to have to linger longer than necessary. The thought of that was comforting. By some means I passed the evening, but my fear took on a myriad of different expressions over which I had no control. Sometimes I felt a powerful sense that something was stirring in the atmosphere. The air became damp, heavy, and pungent, and I would gladly have bolted at those moments and slept in my car overnight had it not been so very cold outside. Finally, I concluded the best place for me was in bed with my back against the headboard and my blankets pulled up close around. And so, half propped up, I must have fallen asleep that way. On waking, I was not cold, and there was no noise, and I knew it was no longer night. There was light enough to see, but what I could see was senseless in the extreme. For I was looking in detail at the ornate ceiling rose above my bed. Its acanthus leaves, bulky and overlaid, some half unfurled. I stretched my fingers up, captured as I was in a state of innocent puzzlement, and felt the deep contours of the thing. And it was true that some of the objects that floated by me looked curiously unsurprising in the small span of time before I understood what had happened. There were sheets of white paper, lapping together, and forming a mass. My sweater moved past me, its grey arms undulating as it progressed. There were my shoes, but not close to each other. I could see my towel below me, just lifting from the bed, and the thing that touched my thigh was my open rucksack, with books and my work papers departing from it in a leisurely stream, and sinking downwards, slowly. The bedside lamp bobbed somewhere to my left, close to the window, tangled in its cord. Two linen antimacassars with crocheted borders moved past me like strange sea creatures. Curtains had lifted and were spread across the surface of the water close to the ceiling, so that I could clearly see out through the window below them, and it was sight of the world outside that brought my situation fully to me, along with a noise that I knew had begun in my head, a kind of rhythmic, half-animal pleading. I was going to drown. Should the water rise higher? I placed the palms of my hands on the ceiling and pulled myself across the room towards the window and the light, and on doing so I looked back and down and saw that the bedroom door was closed, and I am not so strong a swimmer that I could imagine reaching it and opening it. I was searching for something heavy. I was now close to the window and directly above the ugly kidney-shaped dressing table, and there I spotted my precious laptop glinting square and silver below me. I was afraid to swim downwards and have my whole face in Jack Werrett's water, but there was nothing within my reach that I could break the window with, and my fists and feet had no effect at all on the glass panes. I went down, pushing my body through the water hard with a trembling lungful of breath, barely enough for the task, yet I did reach the dressing table, and came upwards, clutching my laptop to my chest. I knew the water was getting higher as I surfaced again close to the window. I could scarcely keep my nose and mouth in the air that remained, and I was coughing heavily. I know I thrashed at the window pane repeatedly before I managed to break it, and by this time the noise in my head was fully animal and howling. Even so, as I worked, I remembered being in the drawing room with the Werrett sisters, looking upwards at the ceiling for damp spots, and the terrible realization that they had understood all along what could happen here came to agonize me further as I struggled, even with the window well and truly broken so that only jagged shards of glass were left around the perimeter. Water would not flow through. My face was now dangerously close to the ceiling, and with all my might, I punched with the soles of my bare feet at the resistant water within the window frame. I had no regard for the distance I would fall should I break through, and curiously in my hysteria, I thought of creatures like pond skaters, for whom the surface of water is as solid as land is to humans. When finally I felt the surface tension give way, I was not ready for the force with which my action propelled me through that window. I plummeted downwards within a rushing spout of water, and landed wretchedly the frozen ground. The only warm thing I could feel was blood flowing from gashes and cuts on my legs and arms, but I was free. I began to feel the first inklings of elation. I was freely bleeding, I knew, but I was, at last, also bleeding free. I turned my head slowly, and my car was out there, beyond the rusty gate, where the Werrett sisters had stood and gazed up at me on the day. They arrived to protect me from the floodman. I never did go back to Stabman's Reach to find Marina that day. Instead, when my wounds were properly dressed at the little surgery in the local town, I headed straight home, the loss of all my research meaningless to me. I don't get much of a chance to leave London these days, but where once I found the city confining and ugly, with its noise and traffic and endless glittery shops, and would have done anything to get some time away, those claustrophobic feelings don't come to me any longer. I am content where I am in my new job for the diocese. Should ever I become frustrated, I run the tip of my finger down the scar on my forearm and remember the house at the edge of the marsh and how, on seeing me all bloody, the nurse in the local town said, "My goodness, you have been in the wars, haven't you, dear?" Today's story was Jack Werrett, the Flood Man. It was written by Rebecca Lloyd and read by Jasper Lestrange. I hope you enjoyed it, and until next time, sweet dreams.